During one of the attempts to take Patton's life, the native circled around him. One kept urging the other to strike the first blow or fire the first shot. And then a peace came over the missionary because of what he concluded. Encircled in a deadly ring, I realized I was immortal until my master's work with me was done. Not a musket would be fired, not a club prevail to strike us, not a spear leave the hand in which it was held, not an arrow leave the bow without the permission of Jesus Christ. And because he believed that, John Patton could rest his whole weight on God.
Welcome to this Bible study series, For All the Saints, a Bible study written and narrated by Joanne Petersburg. For over 30 years, Joanne and her husband ministered to Cleveland professional athletes, their girlfriends and wives through Athletes in Action. Her husband, Tom, served as chaplain to the Cleveland Browns, Indians, and Cavaliers. Today, Joanne continues to focus on studying, writing, and teaching women's Bible studies. As you listen to these lessons, we encourage you to download the study guides in the show notes of this podcast or by going to radiowannabe.com/Bible studies. My name is Janet Maltby with radiowannabe.com. I'm your host and guide for this study of 8 godly men and women who have gone before us. Their lives mirror the words in this great hymn, God was their rock, their fortress, and their might. This series is designed to be an encouragement for women to walk with God in faith, hope, and perseverance. And now on to our For All the Saints Bible study with Joanne Petersburg.
Scotland, the land of bagpipes, kilts, and castles. But what about the New Hebrides? Are you scratching your head over that one and saying, where in the world are the New Hebrides? Or maybe, if you're a fan of the long-running TV reality show Survivor, you can pin it on a map, because Season 9 of Survivor was filmed in Vanuatu, the current-day name for the New Hebrides. Well, Vanuatu, or the New Hebrides, as it was known in John Patton's day, are a string of islands about 2,000 miles east of Australia. And if you keep going east from the New Hebrides, you'll eventually bump into Fiji. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. Let's back up and let me tell you about John Patton in Scotland. John came into this world in 1824, the first of 11 kids to be born to James and Janet Patton. And what's amazing is that the family lived in a small, 700-square-foot thatched cottage in southern Scotland. You gotta think, they were packed like sardines in that small space. And imagine packing lunchboxes for 11 kids. Now, they could have had a sandwich if they brown-bagged it, but there were still no peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, not for another 70 years. In the middle of the little cottage was a room, a sanctuary of sorts, where John's dad prayed every day, 3 times a day. And as he prayed, John and his siblings could hear their dad weep openly for those who'd never heard the gospel. James and Janet faithfully took their wee ones to church, and their dad didn't load them up in the family car to get them there either. They had to walk. That's right, they had to walk. Walk 4 miles to get there. In the little village where John lived, there was an old castle, an old abandoned castle, a castle that had been abandoned for 100 years. And you gotta wonder, did he and his buddies get to play in the crumbling castle? Or did Mom say, now John, don't be going there, son, it might be dangerous. You gotta think they did. And I think they would have spent hours climbing, exploring, collecting souvenirs, playing hide-and-seek, and pretending to rescue a damsel in distress.
Fear not, young maiden. I shall save thee.
Well, to give you some historical context, on our side of the pond, when John was 5, Andrew Jackson was our president. Jackson offered to buy Texas from Mexico. But Mexico said, "No way, Jose." And in England, when John was about 10, the Prince of Preachers, Charles Spurgeon, was born. Sometime in his youth, John not only gave his heart to Christ, he also resolved to become a missionary. And when he was 33, John Patton felt God calling him to the New Hebrides. Friends tried to persuade him, "John, don't go there. Don't go there, John." "Why?" "Because of the cannibals. The cannibals are going to eat you." And they weren't kidding. Christian missionaries to these islands had been killed and cannibalized within minutes of arriving. In fact, the last recorded act of cannibalism there was as recent as 1969. That's in my lifetime. Despite the warnings, when John was 33, he and his bride Mary left Bonnie, Scotland, and set sail for the New Hebrides. 7 months later, they arrived on the island of Tanna in the southern part of the New Hebrides. Within 3 months of arriving, his wife lay dying from a tropical fever. Their month-old baby lay beside her, dying also. Mary looked up at her husband and whispered this, "John, I do not regret leaving home and friends. If I had to do it over, I would do it with more pleasure. Yes, with all my heart." He was alone now among the savage people. Patton passed through some of the darkest days of his life. He often went to their grave to pray and concluded this, "But for Jesus and his fellowship, I must have gone mad beside the grave and died." What got him through those dark days? He clung to his life verse from Matthew 28, "I am with you always." You see, he believed he was never altogether forsaken. Even though there were hundreds of times the natives vowed to take Patton's life with muskets, clubs, spears, and fire. And each time, God miraculously intervened. But the persecutions became so constant and cruel, it became impossible to stay. He was driven out just 4 years after he arrived. 4 years after that, when he was 42, Patton returned with his second wife, Maggie, this time to the nearby island of Annawa. Over their 40 years there, they experienced both tragedy and triumph. 4 of their children died there. Of their 6 surviving kids, 2 became missionaries there, and 1 married a missionary there. And get this, John stayed there until the entire island had been converted. What broke the back of heathenism in Annawa? A well. Digging a well. See, water was scarce, and the natives were afraid of getting what they called rain from below. This was something their idols couldn't do. So men dug, Patton prayed, and God provided. And the natives cried out, "Jehovah is the true God." Listen to the impact of John Patton's long, faithful ministry. His Annawa New Testament that took him 30 years to complete is still in use today. He inspired many others to go to the mission field. By the time of his death, there were hundreds of missionaries on 25 of the islands in the New Hebrides. Today, 90% of the population of Vanuatu claim to be Christians. 14% of those are evangelicals. When John died in Australia in 1907 at the age of 82, maybe he thought back to what he wrote in his autobiography in 1891. "If God gave me back my life to be lived over again, I would, without one quiver of hesitation, lay it on the altar to Christ, that he might use it as before, especially among those who have never heard the name of Jesus." Why would he say that? Maybe because of all the times he heard his dad weeping over the lost who'd never heard the gospel. Maybe because he saw God miraculously intervene in his own life. Maybe because he wanted to make an eternal difference. Maybe because of what John learned and applied about faith. The natives in the New Hebrides didn't have a word for faith in their language. Patton struggled with, how am I going to translate it? Then it came to him. One day, a native who had been running hard came into the missionary's house. He flopped into the large chair and said, it's so good to rest my whole weight on this chair. That's it, Patton cried out. That's how I'll translate faith. I'll translate faith as resting one's whole weight on God. You see, faith is trusting in the chair's ability to hold all my weight. It's surrendering control to the chair or to God. And that's not always easy to do because Satan's always shooting his fiery darts our way. And we need to extinguish those. But how are we going to do that? Ephesians 6 talks about our spiritual battle gear. Verse 16 says, take up the shield of faith. Take up is a command. That implies responsibility on our part. We take it up so that we can extinguish the flaming arrows of the evil one. The shield was covered with leather, leather that had been soaked in water, so it would extinguish the enemy's fiery darts. And the shield Paul was referring to was large. It was 4.5 feet high, 2.5 feet wide, and that size shield gave full protection to the soldier of that day, because soldiers in Paul's day were much smaller in stature than today. Now, if faith is resting our whole weight on God, how does faith display itself? One of the main ways is in our obedience. So let's look at Abraham's faith and see how his faith displayed itself in obedience. Abraham had to wait 25 years for Isaac, his child of promise, to be born. Now you may remember that when his wife finally conceived, Abraham was 100 years old, and his wife Sarah was 90. A little past her prime, wouldn't you say? And in today's passage, Isaac was not a little boy. He was a teenager, or maybe as old as 25. Genesis 17:19 says that Abraham's only hope of seeing the Abrahamic covenant fulfilled was Isaac. This is what God promised Abraham in verse 19. Sarah, your wife, will give birth to a son for you. You will name him Isaac, and I will confirm my covenant with him and his descendants as an everlasting covenant. God specifically named Isaac as the son through whom God would keep his covenant promise. The question was, had Isaac become an idol? Did Isaac take the place of priority in Abraham's life, the place that rightfully belonged to God? The answer is found in Genesis 22, verses 2 through 9. Take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah. Go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering. The next day, Abraham got up early. He saddled his donkey and took two of his servants with him, along with his son, Isaac. Then he chopped wood for a fire for a burnt offering and set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day of their journey, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Stay here with the donkey, Abraham told the servants. The boy and I will travel a little farther. We will worship there, and then we will come right back. So Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders, while he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them walked on together, Isaac turned to Abraham and said, Father, we have the fire and the wood, the boy said, but where is the sheep for the burnt offering? God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son, Abraham answered. And they both walked on together. When they arrived at the place where God had told him to go, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. Then he tied his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Now, if you know the end of the story, you know that God provided a ram in the thicket, but not before Abraham laid Isaac on the altar. Well, what conclusions can we make about Abraham's test of faith? First of all, I think we can conclude that Abraham passed the test of faith this time. And I say this time because there were times he did blow it. There were times he didn't trust God. But this time, his faith was evident. This time, Abraham obeyed, and he obeyed immediately despite whatever emotions he might have had. And he didn't turn back during the 3 days of travel when he would have had time to reconsider, time to justify not going. This time, Abraham rested his whole weight on God. He believed that God would come through, that God would keep his covenant promise. And so Abraham and Isaac left early in the morning. And you gotta wonder, what do you think the night before was like? Do you think he told his wife Sarah what was going on? Did he plead with God? Did he weep? Did he tear his clothes, throw things? Maybe he couldn't sleep, and that's why they left so early. Or did Abraham sleep like a baby because he knew God would provide, as he had said to Isaac in verse 8, God will provide a sheep, my son. Did he believe that, but toss and turn all night, wondering how God would provide? What do you think the journey to Mount Moriah might have been like? It took them 3 days to cover the 50 to 60 miles they would have to go to get to the designated hill, the very same mountain where God offered up his only son. Do you think they walked in silence? Or did they share childhood memories and say things like we might say today, like, hey, Isaac, remember when you thought you could fly and you jumped off your dresser drawer and broke your arm? Or did they talk about God's character and the promises that God had made to Abraham and Isaac? And even though he trusted God, did Abraham's heart beat faster the closer they got? Mine certainly would. Once they got there, Abraham told the servants that they would worship. Did they? Worship is giving God what he's worth. It always involves giving something back to God, something that's rightfully his. How do we know if we've worshiped? Tim Keller says this is how we know. If our affections have been moved from our earthly idols to God, and if our will changes to that of trust. And based on this criteria, Abraham did indeed worship, and so did Isaac. In verse 9 of Genesis 22, Abraham laid Isaac on the altar, so Isaac knew he was the sacrifice. Did he struggle? Did he try to run away? Well, according to Jewish tradition, Isaac was a willing sacrifice who threw himself on the altar, just like God's only son would willingly do 2,000 years later. Did Abraham and Isaac ever speak of that day again? And when they got back home, did Abraham say to Isaac, I think it'd be best not to tell your mother about this. Did Isaac ever tell his wife about that day? Did he ever tell his kids? What impact did it leave on him? Most survivors talk about being spared for a purpose, and Isaac certainly knew he had a purpose. Verse 5 of Genesis 22 gives us a glimpse into what Abraham believed would happen. In verse 5, Abraham said to the servants, We, we will come right back. How could he know that? Abraham knew that because Abraham knew God was a covenant-keeping God, a God who keeps his promises. And God had promised in Genesis 17:19 that his covenant promise would extend to Isaac's descendants. Isaac didn't have any kids yet, so Abraham knew Isaac had to live. Hebrews 11:19 gives us an additional insight. It reads like this. Abraham assumed that if Isaac died, God was able to bring him back to life again. Well, how could God ask that of Abraham and of you and of me? God asks us to offer up the Isaacs in our lives, our job, our health, our reputation, success, our possessions, approval, control, our vision of the way life should go. God asks us to offer up anything that we yearn for more than him, anything that we have to have other than God and what he provides, because those things are idols. They're counterfeit gods that enslave us. So God takes us to the mountain, not because he's cruel, but because he wants us to lay our idols on the altar. It won't be easy to lay them on the altar because doing that will rob us of the significance and security we were getting from those idols. Well, what was John Patton's conclusion about his physical safety in the New Hebrides? During one of the attempts to take Patton's life, the natives circled around him. One kept urging the other to strike the first blow or fire the first shot. And then a peace came over the missionary because of what he concluded. Encircled in a deadly ring, I realized I was immortal until my master's work with me was done. Not a musket would be fired, not a club prevail to strike us, not a spear leave the hand in which it was held, not an arrow leave the bow without the permission of Jesus Christ. And finally, what was John Patton's perspective on all his trials? Whatever trials have befallen me in my earthly pilgrimage, I have never had the trial of doubting that perhaps Jesus had made some mistake. No, my blessed Lord Jesus makes no mistakes. When we see all his meaning, we shall then understand what now we can only trustfully believe that all is well. Best for us, best for the cause most dear to us, best for the good of others, and the glory of God. There are times in our lives when it will seem like God's made a mistake. But John Patton believed God's too wise to ever make a mistake, even when it looks like God has. And because he believed that, John Patton could rest his whole weight on God. I want to leave you with four questions for personal reflection, or if you're in a small group, for group discussion. What stands out to you about John Patton's life? What encourages you in this lesson? Resting in the character of God means, as Spurgeon and others have said, trusting in the fact that God's too loving to be unkind, too good to do us wrong, too wise to make a mistake, and too powerful to be thwarted. Why is it hard at times to rest in God's character? And the last one, whatever we yearn for more than God is an idol. John Calvin said our hearts are idol-making factories. What idols do you need to lay on the altar? Thanks to Janet Maltby for hosting and for making the audio version of this lesson possible.
You've been listening to For All the Saints, a Bible study written and narrated by Joanne Petersburg. If you haven't already, be sure to download the study guides of this podcast in the show notes below. And please join us for our next podcast as Joanne speaks on the life of Lina Sandell-Berg, Sweden's most celebrated hymn writer who endured a heart-wrenching tragedy. The words of her hymn that flowed out of that tragedy reflect scriptural truths, truths that can help us weather the various trials in our own life. Until next time, I'm Janet Maltby of RadioWannabe.com. Thanks for listening.